Suns off again tonight, and then back-to-back games on Wednesday and Thursday against the Thunder and the Warriors. And I'll just tease ahead to the end of the segment some interesting speculation about the Warriors that we'll need to keep an eye on, and I'll share that with you here at the end of the segment. But first, Phoenix Suns getting ready for tomorrow's game against Oklahoma City, still trying to kind of figure out their issues right now. They've lost five of their last seven games. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but DeAndre Ayton has been anything but the issue for the Phoenix Suns. Probably his best four-game stretch of his professional career, averaging 22 points per game, 14.8 rebounds per game, while shooting 64.3%. And that doesn't even include his defensive numbers, which I don't have in front of me, which I'm sure are dynamite as well. He got huge praise from Nikola Jokic the other night after the second Nuggets game from over the weekend. We talked a lot about this yesterday, Gambo. Whatever it is that's wrong with the Suns, it's not a DeAndre Ayton problem, that's for sure.
No, he's playing well. Like, you know, he has nothing to do with why they're not winning basketball games. They're not winning basketball games. Joe Booker missed the game, and Booker got hurt and had to miss that second overtime and the first overtime of the first game, and then he didn't play in the second one, and he's not playing well. And Chris Paul, you mentioned Chris Paul's numbers. He's not playing well, and this isn't on DeAndre. Yeah, he's a key piece to what they want to do going forward. He's giving everybody what they want. People complain about DeAndre because, I mean, see the game Luka had last night? I mean, Luka had, like, I don't know, 35 points, 15 rebounds, and 12 assists or something crazy like that. He had an unbelievable stat line. And so there's always the Luka comparison and DeAndre's lack of aggressiveness. But he's given the fans what they want. The people that complain about DeAndre Ayton, and I wasn't one of them, you know, they complained about the lack of aggressiveness offensively. Well, he's given you that because it hasn't transpired into wins. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, they need other players to play better.
They do. As we went round and round about this yesterday, I'm not even blaming DeAndre Ayton. It's just I would have thought it's weird, it's strange, and I guess kind of ironic that everything we've ever wanted from DeAndre Ayton we've gotten in the last week and a half, and it's led to a 1-3 record. Not his fault. It's sort of a strange dynamic because you would have told me that DeAndre Ayton was going to turn this corner, and hopefully it's a permanent thing, or at least a mostly permanent thing. If you would have told me he was going to turn this corner like this,
yeah,
I would have said
wins.
They would have gone 3-1 in a four-game stretch. Not 4, not 1-3 in a four-game stretch. You expect wins. Yeah, you do. He got an unbelievable compliment from Jokic after Saturday's game. Quote, that guy's amazing. He knows what he needs to do to get better. He stopped me 4, 5, 6 times. Give him a lot of credit. He's a great player. DeAndre Ayton today in meeting with the media via Zoom after Suns practice was asked about what Jokic said about him and his thoughts on that.
That's amazing. I'm doing something right. I give him his praise. You know what he mean to me. That's the biggest, that's the number one center in this league to me. And, you know, just what he do and what he brings to the game is tremendous. And I always look up to it and try to take things from him and, you know, just try to learn from it and put it in my game as well. No matter how you try to shut this dude down, he still finds a way, you know, to be the player he is. And, you know, I love competing against him and, you know, talk here and there while we battling. And, you know, it's just good spirits. And just to hear that, he means, you know, it's making me want to keep working for real, you know. Just hearing the recognition of my hard work is amazing. I just want to keep working harder and harder.
And fortunately, the ultimate compliment of that game, and this is a knock on Frank Kaminsky, but it's the truth. The minute DeAndre Ayton fouled out of that game on Saturday, it was over. It was over because you knew Frank Kaminsky was going to have to try to defend Jokic, and that just wasn't going to work out real well for either one of them. And sure enough, as soon as Ayton picked up his six, that game, in essence, outside of a Jay Crowder three that sent it to double overtime, that game basically over.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Jokic said he just needs a little bit more experience. He's going to be great. He's going to be really, really great. I mean, he had a lot of praise for DeAndre Ayton. DeAndre Ayton's 22 years old. And I can say this till I'm blue in the face, man. Bigs need more time to develop. This kid wasn't playing basketball when he was young. He was playing soccer. You know, there's so much potential. He is a really good player. He is a really good player. Can he get to great and superstar and all of that stuff? I mean, time will tell. But some of the animosity against DeAndre Ayton, I've just never really understood. Again, elite defensive rebounder, and he's 22. You want to trade him? I mean, Why? Like, then it's not going to happen. You develop a guy like that. He's got a chance to be a special, special player. And when a guy like Jokic has no reason to say anything nice about him, there's no reason. He wasn't, like, prodded to say it. He said it because he meant it. He said it because, man, that guy gave me a hard time. These matchups against him aren't easy. You know, Jokic is one of the truly great players in this game, and he's going out there saying what a hard time it is, how hard it is to go up against DeAndre Ayton. It's a lot of work. He's got to bust his ass to go have a good game, a great game. And he is. He's a great player. But he had no reason to praise DeAndre Ayton outside of he really believes in the kid.
More from Ayton today on where his game has improved, citing in particular Chris Paul and Jay Crowder.
I'd say the defensive end, Chris Paul, letting me know the type of anchor I am on the defensive end for this team. And, you know, just having confidence with somebody on the floor, even when he doesn't have the ball, you know, just Chris Paul just being our facilitator and, you know, just finding us in our spots and keeping a certain pace to this game and keeping us in our offenses. You know, it brings – it's a lot of chemistry we have to work on, but it brings a fluidity when it comes to the game of basketball and how to play it. Jay Crowder brings a big piece of, you know, seeing him last game knocking down the biggest shots. You know, dudes who've been in situations and sophisticated. It's a lot, man, and it's contagious. It's very contagious, you know, to bring that type of competitiveness to a young group, and we're ready.
Yeah, and he was ready for it. He was excited about it. The conversations that he's had with Chris Paul and Devin Booker about getting better.
Man, them conversations is career changes, life changes, you know, just being real with your brother, little brother, to be honest. But, you know, just taking the constructive criticism that they want the best for you. You know, they're not telling me anything wrong. Just being great, stuff that can help me add to my game and make me be a way better player than I am, that I'll ever know that I could be. So just, you know, knowing where I'm at on the floor, spacing, knowing the game, moving without the ball, you know, communicating on the court where it puts in other opponents when I talk on both ends of the floor, especially the defensive end. Stuff like the simple things like spreading down the floor and just loading up, letting the guard see that there's presence down low when there's a fast break. Just stuff like that, just to reassure me the things that I'm capable of.
Career changing, life changing, Gambo, is what he said about his conversations that he's having with those two.
You know, every time I hear DeAndre Ayton talk about that, I really wish I could hear Kyler Murray talk about that from the Cardinals. I do. I wish there was somebody where Kyler was praising them for teaching him. And I'm listening, I'm soaking it all up, and I'm trying to learn everything I can from these guys. And, you know, you just don't hear that. And I wish that we could have Kyler Murray have those type of influences around him to make him understand that there's a lot of work to do and you got to get better and to push him and to, you know, make him a better player. That's what I think of when I hear DeAndre Ayton talk about the people that are influencing him.
Yeah, boy, that's a really good point. I think there are a lot of Cardinal fans who kind of had hoped that person might have been Larry, and we still don't know what Larry's future is going to be. But man, I well said. I would love to hear Kyler Murray say something similar about that, the way Ayton talks about the influence and the willingness to be coached and to be taught and to have these guys be hard on him the way Booker and Chris Paul and others have been hard on him. That's what James Jones told us a week ago. He said, man, you have to have a lot of humility. You have to be humble to accept that kind of constant criticism and that kind of constant constructive criticism of your game, and that's what DeAndre Ayton has. Now, here's what Ayton doesn't have. We mentioned Kaminsky a minute ago. We're starting to see the trade market in the NBA, at least the rumors, starting to gear up a little bit. I've got one in particular here in a minute the Suns fans might be interested in. But let's talk about a backup center, because it's obvious that with all these depth issues they've had thanks to COVID and health and safety protocols, they could probably use a little depth in that center position, Gambo.
Yeah, I think it's the one thing that you're looking at and you're saying, okay, can this, because with Kaminsky in there, like, it's a body, and he, you know, he's got a little bit of offensive skill to his game, but not much of a defensive skill. And even Saric, you know, I like Saric's ability to, you know, get the offense going, facilitate the offense. He's a good, willing passer. But you do look at some of these centers that I believe are available. Hassan Whiteside is backing up Rashawn Holmes right now. Rashawn Holmes right now in Sacramento. He makes about $2.3 million a year. His role's been reduced to about 10 minutes per game. That could be a quality backup center for you. JaVale McGee, you know, 7 feet, 270. He's a third stringer right now behind Allen and Drummond. And he's playing, he's only logged 15 minutes since Allen got there after that trade. Solid defender, right? He's got three rings with the Warriors and the Lakers, and he played alongside Durant and Golden State. So there's some thought that the Nets may want him because he played alongside Durant. And again, not a big salary. He's only making $4.2 million, but here's a guy that gets you 6-7 boards in about 16 minutes. So I'm looking at some of the backup centers and thinking, you know, when DeAndre's in foul trouble or, you know, when you really need to have a more of the defensive presence, I like McGee and Whiteside. What you would have to give up, I don't know, but those guys don't make a lot of money. So, again, just something to keep your eye on if you're looking for the Suns to go get another big man.
All right, they're not the only ones involved in at least some trade suggestions. Sham Sharania tweeted out and wrote as part of a story on The Athletic, the Warriors and the Pelicans have discussed a potential deal involving Kelly Oubre Jr. Now, he points out, like many conversations around this time, it's a scenario. It's more of a scenario and less of trade talks, more a hypothetical thing. But Kelly Oubre Jr., who's really struggled in his first year with the Warriors, really struggled.
Yeah, don't look at his numbers. They're that bad.
They're that bad. Oh, his three-point shooting numbers are that bad. That starting five. Now, I know they just demoted Weissman and started Looney last night. But their starting five, their net numbers are, it's among the worst in the league, if not the worst in the league, when it comes to starting five units. And a lot of it is Kelly Oubre's shooting. He's been it's off to a terrible, terrible start.
And I feel bad because I got a call from a Golden State sports radio station after they got Kelly Oubre. Tell us all about him. You guys are going to love him. Oh, my God, he's so good. He's a good 3-and-D. He can shoot the ball. He plays great. He can defense. I was praising Kelly Oubre left and right. Like, you guys are going to love him. And they're probably sitting there like, seriously? This guy's terrible.
They're probably replaying cuts for me right now.
Yeah. Don't listen to this guy in Phoenix,
this
man.
Hack in Arizona. Yeah.
He thought Kelly Oubre was good, Kimbo, man. He sold us a bill of goods.
If it makes you feel any better, I told all of my friends and family in the Bay Area, you guys are going to love him. So they're probably thinking, right? Like, Sarah's an idiot. Yeah. So it's not just him. Yeah.
Now he's shooting 21% from three.
But that smile.
25% overall. Last year he shot 45% with the Suns. This year
with those
35%.
Eyelashes, baby.
Yeah. Yeah. But he's got a lot of exuberant energy when he does it. You know, when he's missing 81% of his 3-point shots, he does it with a lot of energy and
with
he points
style.
A lot. So that's cool. With
that's
style,
right.
Man. With swag. There's no doubt. When we come back on the Burns and Gambo show here on 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station, the king of mock drafts has released his latest, and the trend continues for the Cardinals. Defense. That's coming up on the Burns and Gambo. With Mel Kiper Speaks, people listen when it comes to his mock draft.
He's E.F. Hutton. E.F. Hutton.
You have to be a couple of old guys like me and Gambo to understand that reference. But yes, when E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen.
Oh, my God. You know what, you know what I watched last night with my wife? They brought back Name That Tune.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? Name That Tune?
With
I can name that tune
Krakowski
in 7 notes. I can name
and,
it in 6.
And Randy Jackson, right?
Yeah.
The American Idol
5. Name That Tune. We watched like one episode of it. It was like, oh, my God, I used to love that show when I was younger. And they brought it back.
Did it hold your attention, or are you going to give it a second pass?
Yeah,
or was
because it wasn't just like new music. They played old music and stuff, too. So, yeah, it wasn't bad. I might give it another shot. I used to like Name That Tune. I don't know how they can name it in one note. It's crazy. Like, I can name that tune in one note. I couldn't name anything in one note.
There's only so many notes, right? I
mean, yeah. There's
a pretty finite amount of notes there on the keyboard, right? You'd be able to – and tens of hundreds of thousands of millions of songs out there. It's pretty hard to discern them from
Bernsie,
just one
name
note.
Name this song on this one note. Dong.
That's going to be The Boys of Summer by Don.
Yes, correct. You got it. I can't believe it. It's amazing.
You go. Right. Yeah. Mel Kiper Jr., not that he's any better at the mock draft stuff than anybody else, because the honest truth is he's not. In fact, I probably could look at it and tell you that he's not the best mock drafter of them all, but because of his years in the industry, every time Kuiper puts one out, like, oh, Mel Kuiper put out a mock draft today. So let's go over this. The Cardinals with the 16th pick in the draft, he, like a lot of the mock drafts we've seen so far, the Cardinals going with a defensive player in this position. We've seen some cornerbacks. We've seen some edge rushers. We saw a running back in one of the early mock drafts from somebody else. He's got them going Caleb Farley, the cornerback out of Virginia Tech, Gambo.
Yeah, I've seen mock drafts. Daniel Jeremiah had him go into the Broncos. I saw a different mock draft that had him go into the Giants. Look, you know the Cowboys, I think I saw him go into the Cowboys. Solid, strong cornerback. Good size, 6 feet two. He gives you that size that you want at the cornerback spot. Was a dominant player at Virginia Tech. You know, makes all the sense in the world. And I think Surtain is gone. Patrick Surtain is gone by the time the Cardinals pick. I think in this mock draft that Kuiper had, I think he went 12th. So that gives you, you know, after Surtain's gone, I think this is the next cornerback off the board. And again, I mean, He opted out this season, so you didn't get a chance to watch him play because he did opt out. But, you know, in 2019, he had four picks, bunch of tackles. He's got good size. But, you know, you're not going to see any tape from him this year because he decided not to play.
Yeah, it's and that makes it tough to, you know, tough to kind of evaluate your it's a risk, right? You're taking a chance, kind of like the same thing with that edge rusher we were talking about the other day from Miami. There's not a whole lot of tape to be able to evaluate. And I saw Mel Kuiper Jr.'s write-up of him as well, and he said, look, he might very well be the best pass rusher in this draft. It's just hard to know because, A, it's not Jalen Phillips, the defensive end out of Miami.
Right.
He said there are no dominant pass rushers in this draft. He might be the top prospect, but it's tough to tell because he was good for Miami, but he had a bunch of concussion issues at UCLA. He missed the 2019 season. He's missed a lot of time, and it seems like some of the options that have been tied to the Cardinals in these very early mock drafts have been with guys who are like Jalen Phillips, who are like Caleb Farley. Well, you look at him and go, they look good, but do we have enough tape on them to know for sure that they're going to be good? And that feels risky at number 16 for the Cards.
Yeah, I mean, this is a, you know, and I think we've talked about Farley a couple of times. I mean, he's a converted quarterback. He's got great size, great physical skills. I mean, you know, speed, quickness, agility, all of that stuff, length that everybody likes. He's got it. And he's got, you know, that size allows him to match up with the physical receivers, good ball skills. But, you know, opting out this year, you better make sure that the tape looks good. And you go through all the interview process with him and make sure that he's the guy. I'm not against the guys that opted out. I'm not. But, okay, Surtain played. He didn't opt out. He won a national championship. And you got to see how great he was. You know, Farley opted out and decided to just get ready for the draft. So I don't fault him for that. Some of these guys just, you know, it seemed to be too much of a risk to play, and for him that it wasn't worth the risk.
I think it's going to be tough to ignore the guys who opted out. You know, I understand and I hear what you're saying. There's going to be an inclination to put more stock and more value into the guys who chose to play. A, because they chose to play, and B, because there's just more, you know, film of them to watch. But so many guys opted out. And I mean, some of the seasons were so much shorter than, I mean, think about even the guy who opted in, hypothetical player from the Pac-12. I mean, how many games did that guy get in? Five, six? I mean, how much tape did you get to watch on somebody like that? It is going to be, and then with the news that the scouting combine isn't going to be anywhere close to what we're used to, it is going to be the strangest, maybe most difficult year to evaluate talent there's ever been, because you're basing these decisions off of college seasons that didn't exist. Or if they did exist, they were shortened. Or if they did exist, they were, you know, broken up by 2 weeks, 3 weeks, depending on the player and the prospect and the team. Weird year to try to put a board together. But, you know, it's the same for everybody. They're all going to have to do the same thing. The other highlights from the mock draft, this is from Mel Kuiper. Five quarterbacks in the top 15. Trevor Lawrence, 1. Zach Wilson, 4 to the Falcons. Justin Fields, 7 to the Lions. Trey Lance, 8 to the Panthers. Mac Jones of Alabama, 15th to the New England Patriots. Five quarterbacks in the first 15 picks, Gambo.
I mean, there's so many teams that need a quarterback.
Yeah.
The Lions are going to need a quarterback. The Falcons are going to need a quarterback. The Panthers are going to need a quarterback. They're not tied to Teddy Bridgewater long term. The New England Patriots, they need a quarterback. So, like, I mean, that makes sense. And these quarterbacks, like, I liked the Mac Jones kid from Alabama. Don't know much about Trey Lance outside of some highlights I've seen from him. Justin Fields, I'm kind of iffy on. I mean, my gut feeling is I don't think he's going to be a good pro. But, you know, the few games that I watched him play this year, I saw him play one great game, you know, in the college football playoffs. He was outstanding in that first game. Mm-hmm. But the championship game of the Big Ten against Northwestern, he was just terrible. I love Zach Wilson, the kid from BYU. I think he can make every throw out there, literally every throw. So I'm a big fan of his. So I understand why he's got Zach Wilson going ahead of Justin Fields. I was always of that belief, too. The biggest thing is he's got the Jets taking Devontae Smith, who is apparently not going to get measured at the combine, right? He's going to wait for his pro day. He's not going to get measured. I think I read something
the senior
about
bowl.
That.
The senior bowl. He's not getting, the senior bowl is this week. He's not getting measured the senior bowl. Yeah,
because he's probably going to grow about 3 inches between the senior bowl and his pro day. You know? I mean, there's a good chance.
That's a very
you know, that if he drinks
chance.
His milk and that he can,
sleeps
you know,
upside
he can
down, right? Stretches sure. out his body. Yeah, he sleeps in one of those upside-down machines. Sure, yeah.
yeah. You stretch yourself a little bit, right? You just you stretch yourself every night. You have somebody pull your legs, somebody pull your arms, that maybe he can gain 3 inches. that makes no sense to me. I don't understand it, but whatever. The Jets are taking him number two on Kuiper's board. Not taking a quarterback, but taking Devontae Smith number two overall, the dynamic wide receiver out of Alabama who – in the championship game, just blew everybody away with his unbelievable speed and skill and ball catching ability. And to take a wide receiver that high is a little odd. But if he's that special of a talent, you could see it happening.
Today is the day we find out who's getting into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And based off of what at least I read this morning, there's a possibility that nobody's getting into the Hall of Fame this year. We'll tell you the latest of what we know next on the Burns and Gambo Show. To start this conversation, I want to read you this line from a story I read on ESPN.com today. 2021 Baseball Hall of Fame. Everything you need to know on ballot reveal day. And this is from David Schoenfeld, one of their really good baseball writers over at ESPN.com. He writes, "Welcome to the 2021 Hall of Fame ballot. It includes one player who was suspended for PED use, more alleged PED users, players with domestic violence allegations, one strong candidate with two DUI arrests, and one pitcher who has become notorious for his polarizing social media posts. It is all a chaotic mess. At the heart of the confusion, voters face one key question. Are you honoring the person, or are you honoring his career on the field?"
And that, you're honoring his career on the field.
That is why, Gambo, there might not be a single person elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame this year, because nobody can quite figure out whether they're honoring the person on the field or whether they're honoring the person. And in that gray area, a lot of players are losing a lot of votes, and there might not be a soul in this year's class.
I am not in favor of any of the steroid users getting in. So I don't want Barry Bonds in, and I don't want Roger Clemens in, and I don't want A-Rod in. But that's me. You know, that's how I feel. I don't want the steroid guys in. Some people will vote for the steroid guys, and some won't. Look, I don't believe that Curt Schilling is going to get in. I spoke with him just a couple of minutes ago, and, you know, he said that he has not gotten a call and that he would have gotten a call by now if he was going to get in. So, you know, I think he's going to miss by less than 10 votes to get in. But, you know, what Curt told me is he thinks that that he would have gotten the call by now if he was going to get in. So I don't think he's going to get in, and he's obviously got one of the greatest postseason resumes that any pitcher ever had. Curt Schilling, postseason record, is 11 wins and 2 losses with an ERA of 2.23. That's 19 starts. He averaged 7 innings a start. Plenty of stories from people that I'm looking at, you know, Gordon Whitmire, why I voted for Curt Schilling for the Hall of Fame, and But his numbers and what he did in the postseason is remarkable. Six All-Star seasons, three times he was a Cy Young runner-up. He has the best strikeout-to-walk rate of anyone with 3,000 strikeouts, a really good ERA in the steroid era, more than 200 wins, three World Series rings, and that postseason record is just, man, that just sticks out like a sore thumb, that postseason record.
Yeah, and I think we, you know, all know the reasons why Curt Schilling, if he doesn't think he's going to get in, we probably all know the reasons why that's not going to happen today. The reveal is coming up in the next 25 minutes or so, and we'll find out if anybody does. And, of course, the other guys that I was referring to are, you know, the Manny Ramirez's, the Barry Bonds, the Roger Clemens of the world. The Todd Helton was the one with the DUIs that I mentioned. Omar Vizquel was the one with the domestic violence potential charges that are kind of hanging over his head. And it's weird because, I mean, you and I are a couple of, you know, quasi old school baseball guys, right? And man, we used to look at this day and we would have debates about players and whether their careers were worthy of being in the Hall of Fame. And we were having conversations about their careers, right? About their numbers and how it stacked up. And the era they played, that is not the conversation anymore. And in a way, man, sympathy is the wrong word. I don't feel bad for the guys for the people who have to make these decisions and vote on this. But I understand it's a very tricky thing you're doing when you've got that ballot in front of you and you've got to choose who's on and who's not. And you have to not just factor in a baseball career, but you have to factor in steroids and DUIs and domestic violence and
right.
Polarizing social media posts. I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot sure. To consider.
No, yeah, you're,
if you're, you're one of these baseball Hall of Fame writers, you know, it's sure. It's tough.
Yeah, there's wife beaters, adulterers, drug addicts, alcoholics. You know, all of that stuff, you know, is out there. And the PED thing is a really toxic conversation because some people will say, well, Roger Clemens, or Barry Bonds would have got in, before he took the PEDs, his numbers would have been good enough to get in. And then, you know, Roger Clemens, man, his career was over with Boston. He goes to Toronto, and all of a sudden, you know, he's Roger Clemens again. He looked like he was done in Boston, and a lot of people relate that to PEDs. The PED things, you know, to me, I would not put the PED guys in, and that's me. I mean, McGuire's not in. I think he's the only guy with 500 home runs that's not in.
Right,
but it looks like nobody's going to get in. You know, again, in checking with Schilling just a short time ago, he had not at 3:30, he had not received a phone call saying that he's in, and by now I think he would have got in. I mean, I can obviously make an argument for Schilling, and I'm sure you can too, based on baseball. You know, I mean, listen, you know, he never took, you know, PEDs, he never drove drunk, he never hit a woman, I mean, never committed any crimes. But, you know, people don't like his politics. But as a baseball player, if you're judging it on his baseball as a player, my God, he was just a great, great player. And I think that what he did as a player is worthy of him being in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
If he doesn't get in today, the 2022 ballot, boy, you talk about an explosion. If he doesn't get in today, this time next year, the 2022 ballot will include him for the last time, Bonds for the last time, Clemens for the last time, and A-Rod for the first time. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Good luck. Good luck trying to parse through all of that. The announcement
is
coming
up. A lot of writers don't even want to vote on it anymore. They feel like the Hall of Fame has put them in a tough spot where they've got to be the judge and the jury on
sure.
The PED users. I mean, I've seen quite a few articles from baseball writers be like, hey, here's why I'm not voting this year, and I'm not going to vote. And I was just baffled by it. I mean, was Jason Stark one of them?
I don't recall.
Was that who it was?
I don't know. I can't recall.
Okay, you don't recall. Okay, sorry, I didn't hear the part. Yeah, I think there was quite a few baseball writers, prominent baseball writers, that just opted out. They said, you know what, I'm not going to vote.
Do you blame them?
You made it too difficult.
Do you blame them? I mean, that's a hard job. It used to be a much easier job. It's a real hard job now. It's a hard job trying to, you know, I have to be moral judge and jury on Curt Schilling. I have to be moral judge and jury on Barry Bonds. You know, I have to be, or do I not have any morals at all and just go with baseball? And if I do, it's complicated. It's so complicated. You know,
I think it was Buster. It might have been Buster Rowland. I can't remember who it was, but okay. There was a few of them that decided not to participate in it this year.
Following up on a story from yesterday, by the way, you asked the question, and I read a story that answered it but didn't answer why. Yesterday, it was learned that the Cactus League had sent a letter to Major League Baseball in which it called for spring training to be delayed. It was signed by all the mayors or city managers of all the various municipalities that host Cactus League games, and they had all asked baseball to pause so that Arizona could get a little get their numbers better when it comes to COVID. You asked this question. I found this blurb from Nick Bocoro on AZ Central as part of his story on the topic. The Cactus League does not have the power to unilaterally change the season's February 27th start day. That authority is collectively bargained between baseball's owners and players. With multiple reports indicating the owners are in favor of a delay, the Cactus League's letter could be interpreted as an attempt to ratchet up pressure on the players. Now, we talked about that yesterday. Like, is this letter like leverage to get the players to delay starting the season? It was reported today, Gambo, by The Athletic that somebody from Major League Baseball encouraged members of the Cactus League to write that letter for Commissioner Rob Manfred, voicing a desire to delay. Now, that's interesting, because if baseball asked the Cactus League to write that letter, then you might see why the Players Association would look at that letter as kind of forced leverage to get them to delay the start of the season, sure, which both sides would have to agree to do. If that report is accurate, that's an interesting twist to all this conversation.
Yeah, you can't sugarcoat this. The players want 100% of their salaries, and they don't care if nobody goes to the ballpark. If you're an owner, you don't want to pay 100% of the salaries when you're only getting half the revenue. You know, when you're not, you know, you're not going to have any fans in the stands and concessions and signage. You're not going to get signage and naming rights and all of that stuff that takes a hit. So, as an owner of a team, you know, you're saying I can't count on 2 million people coming through the turnstile or 2.5 million or what, you know, whatever that number is, and you generate your budget on that. I mean, everybody right. does a budget before the year, and your budget is based on how many people you think are going to come to the ballpark. And if you're off by 50 or 100,000, okay, so be it, but everybody bases it on, you know, 1.7, 1.8, 2, 2.5, 3 million fans coming through.
For what it's worth, the Major League Baseball spokesman said it is, quote, categorically untrue that MLB requested the letter from the Cactus League. The author of the letter will confirm this fact, close quote. And then Bridget Binsbacher, she's the executive director of the Cactus League, and I hope I said the name correctly, quote, during that meeting, she said that during the meeting, leaders shared their views. Any suggestion there was pressure from any entity to write the letter is false. So the Cactus League is denying the report. Major League Baseball is denying the report, but there is that report from The Athletic that suggests they were encouraged to write that letter when it comes to the negotiations that you talked about between the players and the owners. When we come back, after another tough loss to the Wildcats last night, ASU season, what's left and what's next? That's next on the Burns and Gambo Show. Well, I'm not going to lead Gambo to any emotions when it comes to ASU, U of A, because I'm going to be honest with everybody. I turned that game off at halftime. I didn't know the final score until I woke up this morning, because I'm like, this is done. This is. Hey, I love watching Dave Pasch and Bill Walton go back and forth. That's entertaining, but not entertaining enough where I wouldn't rather just go to bed and see what the final score is, because this is impossible to watch. I don't want to watch this anymore. And so I went to bed.
I think part of the reason why I continued to watch, I just wanted to see how bad it could get. Like, how bad can it be? I mean, is ASU going to show any heart, any courage, or just continue to be humiliated by their arch rival in a game? I just you almost couldn't believe what you were seeing when you were watching it. You could have taken a high school team that could have showed up and played with more courage and heart than ASU did.
You could. They showed none of it last night, and they were they couldn't shoot, and they couldn't defend, and there weren't guys playing hard. And Doug Howler, as he always does, wrote about it so well on the Athletic website. He said, now the biggest worry for Bobby Hurley might be the lack of fire on his team. It's not, and who knew we would ever have to worry about that out of a Bobby Hurley team, right? When you look at him and who he is and what he's all about, you could come up with a laundry list of why ASU basketball has problems. A lack of fire is one that you would never expect from a Bobby Hurley team, but that team showed up, and this is why I turned it off. That team showed up and looked like a team that knew they had absolutely nothing to play for the rest of the year and just wanted to get it over with. And that's something I never thought we'd see from a Bobby Hurley team, ever.
No, listen, you just don't know, right? High expectations. And, you know, we saw this with the Diamondbacks. You've got high expectations. And then all of a sudden, before you know it, the season gets away from you so quick. I mean, the Diamondbacks season was over before we knew it, right? I mean, same thing here. I mean, they're done. Like, they're done. They're not going anywhere. There's no NCAA tournament. There's not. And I think when you've got these high expectations to go, you know, go to the NCAA tournament, win the Pac-12 championship, maybe go to the Sweet 16, maybe even the Elite Eight, and all of that's gone, you got to find a way. You got to find a way to motivate yourself to play. Now you think it's easy, right? You thought, oh, you just go play. You know, playing a college, you're playing a sport. It's college basketball. But it's not. It's not. It's not as easy as everybody makes it out to be or thinks it is, because you have these goals to do something with this team, and you think the team is special. And when that's taken away, before you can blink, I mean, they haven't won a game since, what, December 12th, the last time they won a basketball game? So I think that's part of it. I think that this season got away from them in a hurry, and they can't wake up from this nightmare. They can't.
Yeah, and now it. And let me before we kind of move it to a bigger picture question here. Here's Bobby Hurley, who just said Arizona was the better, hungrier basketball team last night.
The bottom line was Arizona was the hungrier team, and they were more ready to play right at the start of the game. And it was really there wasn't a whole lot we could do. I commend our effort in the second half, but. The cabinet is filled with moral victories, so I'm not really, you know, that enthusiastic that we put together a decent second half, but not many positives to take out of this.
I didn't watch the second half. I already told you I went to sleep. I can't imagine there was enough good in the second half to even remotely think that would be some kind of a moral victory for ASU last night.
Here's what happened in the second half. And I watched it because, again, I wanted to see the carnage, right? I wanted to see how bad it could get.
You're into the self-punishment thing for some reason. I don't know why. You could have just made it really easy on yourself by turning it off. But, okay,
I just couldn't believe what I was watching. I mean, I just couldn't believe that. I mean, it was no fight. I mean, it's like getting punched in the face over and over and over again and not fighting back. I mean, that's what it was like. I mean, it was no fight. No, just keep hitting me. Keep hitting me. Keep hitting me. I mean, it just kept growing and growing and growing. And, you know, in that game, I mean, ASU, I mean, that first half, they were 1-14 from three-pointers. But they started the game 0-11 from the field. And then at one point, they were 2-17 from the field. And then at one point, they were 3-24 from the field. And you're like, oh, my God. Like, I mean, talk about not being ready to play the game. So I wanted to see the second half just to see. And Akinjo opened the second half. He hits a three, and it was 43-18. For the first 10 minutes of the second half, I mean, it stayed around 22, 24, 25. I think it got to 26. It stayed in that area. And in the final 10 minutes when U of A knew there was no chance that ASU was going to come back, they made a little bit of a run. They cut it to 10. They cut it to 9, I think, at one point. But the game was over. But the first 10 minutes of the second half, they weren't able to cut into that lead at all. It was the second 10 minutes where they were able to cut into the lead.
Now, here's the question, the big picture question that we obviously won't have an answer to, but it's just kind of been bouncing around in my brain ever since I started thinking about this game, is ASU made tremendous strides this year in terms of going after these one-and-done guys, right? Their recruitment of Josh Christopher was, in the moment, in real time, seen as a huge success, that they were able to get a guy like that to come here. And that was, in part, mostly what fueled this idea that ASU could be what I believe was Andy Katz who called them a sleeper Final Four team. where Joe Lenardi had them in his initial bracketology as a 5 seed, right? A lot of that was centered around the return of Remy, the return of Alonzo Verge, Josh Christopher, Bagley showing up. Okay, it seems like what you've got on this team right now is this weird dynamic between a bunch of seniors who are gone and a bunch of young players who might be one-and-done players or who might come back because they find they didn't have a very good season. Will Bobby continue to go the one-and-done route, or will this season convince him that that was the wrong approach because he built a faulty basketball team based off of that approach? That, to me, is the question that I do not know the answer to.
I think you get, if you could get a great player, you want to coach great players. You do. You want to coach superstar players. So I think if you could, if he could get those guys, I think he's going to still get those guys.
Because remember, Krzyzewski, Calipari started doing the one-and-done thing, right? And Krzyzewski was kind of late to the party, and he started doing it too. It took Krzyzewski a while at Duke to kind of get the hang of the one-and-done thing, because it's a certain kind of guy you got to go get if you're going to play that game.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's obviously difficult because, you know, these guys come in there and you know, they're not committed to the program. They're not going to go to school. You know, they're going to come in and they're going to be there for 6 months. And then, you know, in January, they're going to stop going to classes. So, like, that's, you know, that part's hard. You can't count on them for next year. But, you know, the chance to have great players, the chance to, I mean, Syracuse won with Derek Coleman. You know, I mean, does Jimmy Boeheim have a national championship if he didn't recruit Derek Coleman? So I just think that there are a lot of examples of great players that had success as one-and-done guys. And I don't think you shy away from getting those players.
Yeah, it's just you just have to make sure it's the right one-and-done guys. And I'm not trying to blame this all on Josh Christopher or Bagley or anything like that. It's obvious the mix this year is not working. I agree you still go after the great players, but maybe you have to kind of refine your search a little bit to make sure it fits what you're trying to do, because this year has just been an absolute disaster for ASU basketball. No other way to put it. An absolute disaster.
Total embarrassment.
When we come back.
I mean, they should be embarrassed, especially with that performance last night. I mean, clearly they don't care about playing basketball right now. And if you know, Bobby's got to wake them up somehow, then he'll have to wake them up. But, yeah, that was really sad to watch.
The 4 o'clock reset is next with all of the top stories, including who, if anybody, is going into the Baseball Hall of Fame. All the details coming up next on the Burns and Gambo Show.